Shrink Wrap Radio number 330, Unlocking the Emotional Brain with Bruce Ecker.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is psychotherapist and author Bruce Ecker, and we'll be discussing his work on eliminating symptoms at their roots using memory reconsolidation. Bruce Ecker, MA and licensed marriage family therapist, is co-originator of coherence therapy and co-author of Unlocking the Emotional Brain, Eliminating Symptoms at Their Roots Using Memory Reconsolidation. He's also written a depth-oriented brief therapy, How to Be Brief When You Were Trained to Be Deep, and vice versa, as well as the book The Coherence Therapy Practice Manual and Training Guide, and the forthcoming Manual of Juxtaposition Experiences, How to Create Transformational Change Using Disconfirming Knowledge in Coherence Therapy. He is in private practice near San Francisco, California, and has taught in clinical graduate programs for many years. His publications and conference presentations since 2006 describe how therapists can make use of the new neuroscience of memory reconsolidation to bring about deep transformational change regularly and consistently. Now here's the interview. Bruce Ecker, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dave. Glad to be with you again.
Yeah, again is right. It's great to have you on Shrink Wrap Radio because I've had two previous fascinating interviews with you on my other podcast, Wise Counsel, which unfortunately I'm no longer doing. So I'm really glad to have this opportunity to share you and your very exciting work with my Shrink Wrap Radio audience.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on your new 2012 book, Unlocking the Emotional Brain, which you've co-authored with Robin Tysik. Am I saying her name right?
Tysik.
Robin Tysik and Laurel Hulley. It's all about the use of memory reconsolidation in psychotherapy, which we spoke about 2 years ago in our conversation on Wise Counsel. But now you've really moved ahead and created a written resource, which will be of great value to therapists of all stripes, I think. How challenging was it to get it all written down?
Oh, that's a whole story in itself. The book went through a series of evolutions until we finally came to the form it now has. So yes, it was quite a project for all three of us. It was about 3 years of evolving the book, and then about a full year of intensive writing. So yes, and about 20 years of developing our clinical know-how in using this process have poured into this book. So really, we've tried to make it an embodiment of quite a comprehensive, new, and very advanced body of knowledge.
Yeah, and that really comes through. You, in the book, you're dealing with some fairly complex information about the brain and also about how to do this particular approach to therapy. And I could tell from reading some of the foreword and the acknowledgments, I guess, that you really had to run it through a whole bunch of people to kind of get the explanation down in a really clear way. And I could see just how challenging that would be.
Yes, we had to develop as writers as well as thinkers to create this book. And you're exactly right. We were working very deliberately to learn how to write in a very readable and engaging style in a way that explained very complex and sophisticated ideas. And, well, I hope we succeeded.
Well, I think you did. The first time we spoke about memory reconsolidation in one of our earlier interviews, it was a new concept to me. However, it seems to be an idea that's really catching on and that I'm now encountering in other interviews and books. For example, the interview just prior to this one was with noted researcher Jacques Poncep, who used it as a possible theoretical underpinning for the effectiveness of EMDR to treat some traumatic surgical experiences that he had personally gone through. So before we go any further, I think we should have you tell our listeners just what we mean by memory reconsolidation.
Very good. Well, reconsolidation means that the synapses of a target emotional learning are unlocked for a limited time of about 5 hours, which allows new learning to directly rewrite and erase the target learning. And then the target learning actually no longer exists. So that's what reconsolidation does. It allows new learning to directly erase existing learning. And really, that's the ideal form of therapeutic change. And according to current neuroscience, only the reconsolidation process allows new learning to eliminate an existing unwanted learning. If you don't first launch this reconsolidation process and unlock those synapses that store the target learning, then new learning just sets up separately and competes with the existing unwanted learning. And the new learning seldom wins that competition for long because the unwanted learning is always emotionally very powerful or urgent. So relapses occur.
A new learning for me, as I hear you say this, is that the window is open for as long as 5 hours. Somehow I previously was under the impression that it was a much narrower window of only minutes at the most.
Well, there's quite a few research studies published by neuroscientists demonstrating a window of about 5 hours. When they try certain things at 6 hours, nope. The memory is reconsolidated. The window is closed. The synapses have relocked, and the target learning no longer is susceptible to change. But up to something under 6 hours, that's why I say 5 hours, the target memory is changeable thanks to the reconsolidation process.
Well, this is a fairly remarkable discovery, I think, and the way that you've extended it to psychotherapy is equally remarkable. And also, I would imagine you've had to get a whole bunch of neuroscience, a lot of this information under your belt, which you know probably wasn't any part of your original training. Would I be right about that?
You are right about that. In 2005, we began a systematic, intensive study and reading of original neuroscience research articles in neuroscience journals, searching for whether we could find some established neurological mechanism that might clearly correspond to the sequence of experiences that we had identified that was always associated with these powerful transformational change events that we would observe in our sessions. About 10 years earlier, well, more than 10 years earlier, in the early 90s, we had come to this sequence of experiences which became coherence therapy because we had identified that it's this sequence of experiences that appeared to be always happening when our clients would have profound change events where they describe a deep and emotionally felt and bodily felt shift and long-standing symptoms would cease to happen. So it was 2005 when we decided, you know, we need to see if there's a neurological mechanism that could make sense of this sequence of experiences on that neurobiological level. And we found reconsolidation in the research literature as part of that search. And so ever since late 2005, I've been intensively studying neuroscience reconsolidation research articles. So I've studied, you know, many dozens very closely. I'm a former research scientist myself. I was a physicist long ago. For about 14 years, I was a research physicist.
Uh-huh.
So I'm right at home with, you know, digging into the details.
That helps to explain it for sure.
Yeah, yeah, it really does. I'm not sure I could have done this without that background.
Yeah.
So,
really.
Yeah, I've immersed myself in, and this, the reconsolidation research is very, very complex. There's a lot of subtlety. It took me 5-6 years until, and really until we began writing this book about a year and a half ago now, to finally iron out all the wrinkles and confusions that were so easy to have in understanding this material. And we've just poured this understanding we've come to through this intensive study into the book. Chapter 2 of the book in particular, as you've noticed, is where we condense, again, hopefully in a very readable form, an explanation of the research and what it means for psychotherapy.
Yes. Now, you've written that psychotherapies in general have benefited from recent brain research, both prior to the discovery of memory reconsolidation and since. So it's sort of BC and AD, you know.
Right.
What were the primary neuroscience learnings from therapy prior to the discovery of memory reconsolidation? You say that psychotherapists were already drawing upon information, you know, what was at that time the latest information about the brain. So how was that prior to memory reconsolidation? What was being drawn upon and getting incorporated into therapy?
Yeah, yeah, very important things were already being incorporated. Let's see, but perhaps at the foundation is this recognition of implicit memory and how so much of what had been regarded in a somewhat mysterious manner as the unconscious, starting with Freud, has been translated into an understanding of implicit memory, which is what really what I'm talking about when I use the phrases emotional learning and emotional memory.
Mm-hmm.
Those are implicit forms of memory. It's a very curious type of memory. It's very different than what we usually mean by the word memory. Normally we mean remembering experiences in our lives, situations, circumstances, or remembering facts, such as, you know, 8 times 5 is, what is it, Dave? 40? So,
yeah, don't put me on the spot like that.
Well, you're going to put me on the spot. I got to find ways to do it back a little bit. Come on.
Okay, fair enough.
So that's explicit memory, and that's usually what we mean by memory, and that's how we think about the word memory. But implicit memory is very, very different, and it's very important for therapists to understand implicit memory, and that's a big part of what we got from neuroscience before reconsolidation. Implicit memory is learnings and knowings that you have without being aware of them whatsoever. Whatsoever.
Yeah,
now,
right.
We're all really familiar with it without realizing it, because it's implicit memory that lets you form the words of your next sentence, for example, knowing how to structure a sentence. That's very subtle, sophisticated, complex knowledge we each have that we're not aware of having. We just use it as needed in the moment. So that's a good way to think about implicit memory. The emotional brain learns by extracting patterns or templates. It doesn't remember necessarily the details of the situation in which the learning occurs, but it remembers very, very durably. In fact, forever, unless reconsolidation happens, the patterns extracted from experience and applies those in the present. So that's one big, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Are there any others that come to mind? I know I didn't prime you for this ahead of time, and I know there was a place in the book where you listed probably 6 or 7 things prior to memory reconsolidation that were starting to impact how therapists think. And
yeah, there are several. There's the understanding that because the brain's responses, the emotional brain is based in certain brain regions, there's the recognition that we can use, therapists can guide responses and knowings and strengths that are based in other brain regions. So much of psychotherapy, for example, I think much of cognitive behavioral therapy, is based in the principle that we can use higher, what are usually called higher brain functions, the cortex and the neocortex and conscious thought and positive thinking is another system that uses the brain's other regions other than the emotional brain to cultivate and strengthen preferred responses, preferred thinking, preferred behavior, preferred moods, and to build those up to override and suppress. Well, the word usually used is to regulate the unwanted responses coming from the emotional centers of the brain, which are in the subcortical regions, the amygdala and its associated regions, and the limbic system, and the right hemisphere, too, has important emotional brain regions. So that's another one of the major inputs from neuroscience, the neurological validity of using conscious cortical resources to override and suppress these emotional brain responses. Now, that is, that last thing I just described is what is perhaps most impacted by the new knowledge of reconsolidation.
How so?
Well, reconsolidation tells us that overriding unwanted responses from the emotional brain is not the best you can do. Before reconsolidation, it did seem to be the best we could do. In fact, right up into the 1990s, neuroscientists as well as psychologists, based on almost a century of research, had come to the conclusion that once an emotional learning and an emotional response is formed and put into long-term memory in the emotional brain, it's permanent for life. It's indelible. It cannot be erased. So if that were true, it would mean that indeed the best you can do in therapy is to form preferred responses and strengthen them enough to where they can override the unwanted responses based in emotional memory in the emotional brain. But with the discovery of reconsolidation, boy, it turned the tables. It was really a revolutionary finding because it means that emotional learnings in the emotional brain can be erased. After all, there is this built-in neurological process in the brain that can do that, and that means that counteractive approaches of the kind I've been describing, where you override unwanted responses and suppress them and regulate them, is not the best you can do to eliminate unwanted responses based in emotional memory. You can actually eliminate, delete, erase the very roots, emotional roots and neurological roots of unwanted emotional responses through the reconsolidation process. And that's why we see it as just having massive implications for psychotherapy.
Yeah, but the trick, and it seems like in hit or miss sorts of ways that various therapies and therapists have maybe capitalized on that phenomenon unwittingly in the past, and the trick seems to be to really get into that 5-hour window in a way that's effective, and we'll be talking about that in more detail. You point out that emotional memories, the kinds that you've been talking about, lead to implicit assumptions or schemas about reality that affect our current lives. And I was surprised not to see a reference to Albert Ellis. Didn't he also talk about our unconscious beliefs as underlying neurotic symptoms?
Oh, certainly, certainly. Many, many important therapists and clinical thinkers and writers for a century have developed that understanding. And so our book is not at all an attempt to give an adequate acknowledgement or coverage of all the different sources of this recognition.
You acknowledge so many other people. I mean, it's extensively referenced, and it stuck out to me because his rational emotive therapy, or RET as he called it, does point to the emotional component. But personally, I think he relied maybe too much on his argumentative, rational approach rather than really evoking the underlying emotional memory. What's your take on that?
You've put your finger exactly on it. In other words, I agree completely that's the big difference, and that's why he's not part of our picture, which is not to detract from his importance in the history of psychotherapy. But that's exactly it. The method, the techniques, the style of doing therapy in RET, rational emotive therapy, has that character. I think that's widely recognized. That's nothing new that I'm saying about it or you're saying about it. There's that argumentative, convincing, disproving on a kind of cognitive talk level against the existing beliefs, which are called irrational, maladaptive, pathogenic beliefs, right?
All
those sorts of pathologizing terms are used not only in RET, but very widely in the therapy field still. And you may have noticed in our book, in Unlocking the Emotional Brain, we never use any of those words once.
Yeah, I definitely did notice that. And you underscore that. And I think it's also embodied in the name of the approach. You've come to call your approach coherence therapy. I gather that's not what you originally called it. Why the change, and what does it signify?
Well, the change signifies that...
What was it initially?
Initially, it was depth-oriented brief therapy.
Okay.
Which is also a good description of the approach. But we changed it to coherence therapy mainly because we really wanted to put the emphasis on coherence. We think this approach contributes importantly in that, well, I think therapists of all stripes recognize at this point that we human beings have a very central need to create coherent narratives of our experience, conscious, coherent narratives. And there are therapies that are largely focused on exactly that. What we're contributing is the recognition that the unconscious emotional brain, the whole domain of implicit knowledge and implicit learning, is also fully coherent. When you do the experiential work of bringing directly into a client's awareness the specific unconscious or implicit emotional learnings underlying and driving a specific symptom, those learnings, that deeply emotional, initially nonverbal material, it doesn't exist in words, nevertheless turns out to be very cogent, very well knit, fully coherent, and capable of being put into words that give great satisfaction of capturing the felt meaning to the client.
Okay, so, now I took a slightly different meaning from it. Check me out on this. I got, and maybe you're also saying this, that the things that in the past that have been labeled as neurotic or pathological represent choices that at the time made sense or were coherent with the patient's needs and situation at that time in their life.
Yes, exactly. And the coherence is that these responses, behaviors, moods, thoughts, which from the outside may look irrational, may look out of control and senseless and only negative, may look maladaptive. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. They arise as adaptive, coherent responses to original situations and original sufferings. And what has been shown by the neuroscience research is that the brain is functioning properly in maintaining these implicit emotional learnings from earlier in life and responding according to those learnings in the present. That's now very clear from the neuroscience of memory, that the brain, apparently that was survival positive in the course of the evolution of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
When when any learning occurs in the presence, as I mentioned earlier, of strong emotion or urgency, the synapses that form to store that learning in memory are special synapses. They lock in a special way with, you know, the biological molecules and structures that form create lifelong durability. So apparently any learning formed in the presence of strong emotion or urgency was survival positive to maintain forever. And so the brain is functioning properly when decades after an original emotional learning due to some circumstance in childhood, that response based on that learning is still ready to cut loose in response to anything that looks similar.
Right.
To the original experience. That's not maladaptive. That's not a disorder. That's the brain functioning as designed by evolution. And so our approach is very aligned with that understanding, and approaches such as the RET approach, which attempt to invalidate the existing beliefs maintaining symptoms as if they're irrational and argue against them and guide the client to see how wrong they are, just isn't in the spirit or understanding of our framework.
Yeah, it also makes me think of, I think in at least some forms of psychoanalysis, there is a dictum to not attack the resistance, but to kind of see it as necessary. So in a way, that's kind of related to what you're saying.
Yes.
You say that coherence therapy, in fact, retains the best elements of previous talk therapies while adding greater precision and reliability. So maybe you can talk about the two sides of that, the best elements of previous talk therapies and then the greater precision and reliability.
Well, the therapy done in coherence therapy is very... And in the spirit, and really all the therapies that are in our book, which, you know, as you noticed in the book, we've included case examples of AEDP, Diana Foch's approach, EFT, emotion-focused therapy, EMDR, and IPNB, interpersonal neurobiology, Daniel Siegel's approach. We've included detailed, previously published case examples of those four therapies to show that this same core process that creates memory reconsolidation and erasure of a target learning is present in each of those therapies, even though each of those therapies does not describe itself in terms of the sequence of experiences that creates reconsolidation, but nevertheless, there it is. And in all of those therapies, and in coherence therapy, which we give examples of throughout the rest of the book, the work is very, very emotionally deep. It goes into very vulnerable areas. What we call the retrieval of the emotional learning underlying a symptom, that's very vulnerable territory. And so the therapist's empathy and emotional attunement and sensitivity is fully as important in this way of working as in... and any other form of in-depth therapy. So that's what we mean, that the therapeutic relationship and the emotional quality of the work is not at all diminished in following the brain's requirements for creating reconsolidation.
So even though you've got specific steps, which we'll get into, it's not a mechanical, non-empathic approach.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Those qualities of empathy and emotional attunement are very, very needed for effectively following the steps needed for reconsolidation. And in fact, when I say the steps, I don't want to give the impression that there's anything rigid or formulaic about it. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm sure you noticed, Dave, the steps are defined as steps of process without specifying techniques. The therapist is completely free to use any experiential techniques that he or she is familiar with to carry out the steps. It's a metaphor I like to use is that when you are following a map to get somewhere, the map doesn't specify the means of transportation. You know, you could take a plane or a bus or a train or crawl on your belly, and you're following the same map.
Yeah,
and
that's a great...
It's very similar here. Once a therapist understands these steps of process, this sequence of experiences that the brain requires to unlock and erase a target emotional learning, the therapist is free to arrange to create those experiences for the client in any way that the therapist knows to do that.
Yeah, that sounds great. There's a lot of talk these days about what the APA has called manualized therapies. And I don't know if that's what you had in mind as you developed your approach, but it does seem to have gotten it down to some very specific steps, as we're saying here, which in the book you've labeled ABC, 1, 2, 3, and the letter V. Perhaps you can take us through those steps of coherence therapy.
Sure. Sure. Well, those are actually the steps. Well, that's an interesting comment you just made that I should probably touch on first. Those are the steps, that sequence of seven steps, which we've labeled A, B, C, 1, 2, 3, V. That sequence we call the therapeutic reconsolidation process.
Okay.
That's the sequence that we've shown in the book is present in those four therapies I named, and coherence therapy.
Uh-huh.
So that's not unique to coherence therapy. As you touched on earlier, this sequence that creates reconsolidation has been happening here and there in therapist sessions all over the place. But it has been happening by luck, by intuition, accidentally. You know, what we're trying to do is bring such awareness of these necessary steps to the therapy world that therapists are in a position to knowingly arrange for these steps to happen within whatever type of therapy they're practicing, so that real clinical breakthroughs, deep breakthroughs, can happen much more regularly in day-to-day practice with this awareness of this map.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. And before you get into the steps, what about that manualization that that some portions of APA have really pressed for? And I think there have been mixed reactions in the therapeutic community, and so I'm curious about your take on that and the extent to which that influenced the way you've laid this out.
There are intense controversies raging, well, if that's not too strong a word, about manualization, about evidence-based therapies, all this structuring that's going on. Mm-hmm. No, we didn't write this book or create this framework with manualization in mind. We're trying to make this new body of knowledge as clear and practical and operationalizable as we possibly can. We've also written a manual of coherence therapy separately, and there too we're trying to just put into therapists' hands this know-how. Now, the very word manual or manualization, I think, tell me if you have the same impression. I think it has strong connotations of formulaic, rigid. The therapist loses choicefulness. You're just going to follow rules and be adherent to some prescribed procedure.
That's definitely the connotation that I get.
Yeah, yeah. So what we're creating, if that's what manualization means, we are not trying for manualization. We are trying to chalk out the know-how so clearly that therapists of all stripes can use it immediately. As I said, what makes this framework, we've been using the word framework instead of manualization, talking about the emotional coherence framework as the overarching name of this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the process, the therapeutic reconsolidation process, this ABC 123V, does not boil down to specific concrete techniques that the therapist must use. The therapist has such a free hand in how to bring about each of those steps. See, I think that's what makes this diverge from what is usually meant by manualization. There's tremendous creative freedom. Therapists use their own style. Just a couple of weeks ago, I did a two-day intensive training with my co-director, Sarah Bridges. And after about, by the end of the first day of this two-day workshop, we sort of paused and said, we bet you've noticed that the two of us do coherence therapy with very different styles. And the group really appreciated that acknowledgement. That, mm-hmm. that gave everybody tremendous sense of freedom to make it their own, you know? Therapists sure. have to make it their own and then do it from their own authentic self.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's full latitude for that in this framework.
Yeah, that really makes sense to me. I mean, that really makes it very appealing. Well, take us in some sort of a way through those seven steps.
All right. How much time do we have?
We have, let's see, I have to do my math here. I think we might have about 20 more minutes.
All right, that might be just right. I'll try and do it as succinctly as I can.
I have some other questions, though, as well.
Well, let's see. All right, Lynn, I'll do the briefest version I possibly can do. And I should say that this will be a very light gloss. Really, it takes close study of a number of case examples to begin to arrive at a real nuanced appreciation of what each of these steps really means. But just for an initial impression, I'll be glad to, talk it out.
Yes, and this is no substitute for reading the book.
Yeah, right. All right, step A is learn from the client what to regard as the problem or symptom. Now, that may sound trivial, but it turns out not to be at all. A client comes in and says, well, I'm depressed, or we have a communication problem. Well, you don't know what those words really mean to that person. There's a lot of specificity that is right behind those words.
Mm-hmm.
And specificity of what behaviors, what thoughts, what feelings, what emotions, what bodily sensations are happening that the person regards as the problem happening.
Mm-hmm.
So we initially really focus on learning the experiential particulars that constitute the problem or symptom happening. And we don't go any further until we feel clear enough that we know what's my job? What's the job I'm being given? I'm being asked to help make something change. I need to know exactly what it is that the person wants to change.
Concretely, what's bothering
concretely,
you?
Concretely, yes. Like, how do you know when the problem is happening? I might ask that initially.
Mm-hmm.
I ask whatever I need to ask to elicit or to guide the client's attention to noticing and verbalizing what are the specific thoughts, feelings, bodily sensations, and behaviors, etc., that he or she means. Okay, once I have a sufficient initial understanding of that, then I can move to step B. Step B is this process I mentioned earlier, the retrieval, the experiential retrieval of the underlying emotional learning that's actually necessitating those very symptoms that consciously are so unwanted, so negative. It's going to turn out that they are part of how the person is striving for safety or accountability or justice or well-being in some coherent way, but it's completely unconscious. It's coming from some implicit learning.
So these are deep emotional reactions that are part of their initial survival strategy.
Yes, exactly. So step B is this process of the retrieval work, and this is this deepening emotionally based work, bodily based, emotionally based work of bringing the client into being lucidly in touch with the specific existing emotional learnings, emotional knowledge, urgent tactics. This material always consists of some urgent problem and some urgent solution for solving or avoiding that problem. Whatever the details turn out to be, that's the overall structure of any given emotional learning that's retrieved from its implicit form, which is not in awareness, but into explicit awareness as a result of this retrieval work in step B. And this is where the therapist's empathy and emotional attunement and sensitivity is so important, because this goes into very vulnerable, tender territory.
From my reading of the case examples that you give, this emotional learning survival strategy could originate in childhood, as you know, as Freud and his followers so
it
pointedly
often does.
Underline, but it could also happen later in life, such as with traumatic experiences.
That's right. Yeah, traumatic experiences. Or any other emotionally intense experiences. At any age, the emotional brain forms these powerful schemas or emotional learnings in response to any powerful emotional or urgent experience. So yes, at any age, but you know, so often it is from childhood. So once we have learned the details, the detailed specific makeup of the emotional learning that's underlying and driving or necessitating the presenting symptoms, now we can go to step C. And step C is finding within the client's range of life experience, past or present, some vivid direct experience or vivid personal knowledge that is sharply contradictory of key elements of the underlying emotional learning that was brought to light in step B. And there are many ways to do this. In fact, right now we're working on a manual, here comes another manual, of methods for finding this contradictory living knowledge once the symptom requiring emotional learning has been brought to light and made explicit. You can't do this step, obviously, until you learn what the detailed specific makeup of the emotional learning, the target emotional learning is.
So, is there a quick example that you could give of a B and a C?
Sure. Sure. And this ABC, first three steps, is the we regard that as the preparation phase.
Okay.
Because the next steps, 1, 2, 3, will be the erasure sequence. And that often just takes a few minutes.
Mm.
But you need these ingredients, the details of the emotional learning, the target learning, and the details of some vivid contradictory knowledge. Once you've got that, you can go right ahead into 1, 2, 3 and do the reconsolidation process. This preparation work is the bulk of the work, however. You know, it's like a well-done paint job. All the prep work can take a week or two, and then they start painting, and it's done in a few hours.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We're talking about the preparation phase here. And
yes.
Let's see. All right, for an example, let's see. I knew you'd put me on the spot. You always do. All right. Let's take as an example a man who comes in and says that among other people in social situations or at work, he always feels really tense. You know, really, really tense, anxious, like tight, held back. And so, initially the client's presentation is sort of blurry and not very distinct. So, again, for the sake of moving along quickly here, I'm just going to skip through this with a light gloss.
Sure.
So I do this step A, clarifying, focusing in on specific examples, asking questions. What happened in that moment? What happened in this? What are you feeling when you hear this person say that? And we arrive at this clarity that this man is actually expecting to be harshly judged and rejected if he does anything wrong.
Okay.
And he himself didn't quite really recognize that that's what it's about. All right, so now I start to have the kind of specific clarity I need about what's the problem or symptom that we're dealing with here that I'm supposed to help him get rid of, get free of. All right, so then I launch into step B, the retrieval work. In coherence therapy, we think of it as the discovery work and the integration work. In other words, we're going to first discover what's the underlying emotional learning generating this anxious expectation of rejection if I do anything wrong visibly. And then we're going to integrate that, make that routinely conscious, because it's very unconscious to begin with. And without getting into the details of how we do this focused, efficient, very experiential, fully emotional retrieval work, I'll just give you the fruits of that step for the sake of this example. The man winds up getting in touch with directly and then finding words for this, and the words we come to, and the therapist helps with the verbalization a great deal, as with every other step. The words we come to are, and these words get written on an index card that's handed to him for him to be able to stay in touch with it between sessions. That's a piece of integration work. The words are, if I do anything wrong, it shows Dad or anyone that I'm too stupid to accept or love.
Okay.
So this is based on him having gotten in touch with, in the discovery work, many, many experiences in childhood with Dad, where Dad's trying to teach him something or show him something, like tying his shoelaces. And as soon as he gets it wrong, does it wrong, Dad goes into, you know, anger, loud voice, what are you, stupid? You know, really scary, painful stuff,
yes.
Rejection stuff. So the words he comes to for this emotional truth of his anxiety with people, if I do anything wrong, it shows Dad or anyone that I'm too stupid to accept or love. It's so painful and so scary when I lose Dad's love and instead he hates and rejects me for making a mistake. I've got to keep doing everything right, or it will happen again with anyone at any time. Okay? So
yes.
Those words absolutely ring true. They are this man's emotional truth. That's the verbalization of the underlying learning. You can see it's a schema. It's a whole packet of meanings and knowings, a problem and a solution, a specific vulnerability that is urgent to avoid, and here's how to avoid it. Keep doing everything right, or it will happen again with anyone at any time. So that's the successful or the completed retrieval, step B. With that clarity, now it's time to do step C, find some a contradictory vivid knowledge that can be used in the next steps, as we'll get to.
Uh-huh.
And there are many ways to do that. In a situation like this where the underlying learning centrally involves a huge generalization from the original experiences, it's particularly easy to find contradictory knowledge. This man generalized from Dad being quickly angry and rejecting for any mistake to all other people.
Mm-hmm.
He expects everyone to be like Dad. That's very, very common. I think most therapists have encountered that. The generalization of original emotional learnings with family members to all other people. It seems that human beings almost automatically do that kind of generalizing. And neuroscientists are also very familiar with generalization of learnings. So when you have that kind of generalization, it's usually easy to find exceptions, because even though the person expects everyone to be the same as Dad, in fact, most people are not the same as Dad. And so, fortunately, it'll be easy to find exceptions. And those exceptions are very vivid personal experiences that are very real to him. And we'll stack up several of those and use them. So here's what I did. And by the way, it's crucially important in this step C of finding contradictory knowledge that this has to be very vivid, real stuff for the client. This isn't just positive thinking or good ideas or the client's, you know, sophisticated, rational understandings of how the world really is. This has to be living experience, living knowledge, stuff that the client has felt in his body is real and true, okay? So yeah. I would engage this fellow on looking for the exceptions. I might say, for example, I wonder if we could find some experiences you've had where you made a mistake that was visible to the other person, but he or she didn't respond in an angry, rejecting way like Dad did.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the exceptions tend to stand out in memory. You know, even though the person's not wasn't conscious of the emotional learning before now, nevertheless, yeah. The exceptions to an emotional learning do tend to really pop out in memory. So he would say, for example, that a few months ago he bought the wrong item from his store and he needed to return it. And he expected with anxiety that the store clerk at the returns desk would be really annoyed and disapproving of him for this error, right?
Yes.
And then he was really surprised when the mail clerk was perfectly relaxed and friendly about it.
Uh-huh.
And then he would also remember, say, that, let's say, a coworker came over to him recently and said in a relaxed and friendly way, hey, you know that document you emailed me? Well, it had the April numbers in it, but, you know, it's the May numbers I need. Could you resend it? And again, friendly, relaxed attitude, surprising, even though, you know, he made an error. And so there would be some other incidents, too. So now
okay.
we have both the target learning and vivid contradictory knowledge. So ABC is done, and I can go straight now into the three steps of the erasure sequence, 1, 2, 3. And these are the steps that the neuroscientists have found and demonstrated in our book, in Unlocking the Emotional Brain, in Chapter 2, where we cover the research. We have a table there that lists 10 different replications of identifying these steps in controlled studies by neuroscientists. So step one is to reactivate the target learning. You've got to have the target learning emotionally re-triggered, reactivated. That's step one. So I might say to him, let's take a look at the whole range of your experiences with making mistakes. Let's go over this for a few minutes. And, you know, it would be good if you could allow the feelings of what we revisit along with the ideas of them, okay? And then I would start step one by saying, on one side is all those many times when Dad became so angry and rejecting over some mistake you made. And that was so painful and so scary for you. And you really, really expected ever after that most everyone is the same as Dad, and that anyone will reject you harshly for any mistake. Can you feel that expectation in your body? And so he nods, and so that achieves step one. The target learning is reactivated.
Okay.
Now, as an aside, I'm going to mention to you, Dave, that in the early few years, 2000 to 2004, of reconsolidation research by neuroscientists, they formed the conclusion, based on the initial studies, that this reactivation of the target learning by itself launches reconsolidation and unlocks the synapses storing the target learning. That turns out not to be true. And research that started to be published in 2004 showed that a second step, the step I'm about to describe, is what unlocks the learning. If the first step of reactivation is done by itself without this second step, synapses don't unlock and reconsolidation is not launched.
Hmm.
But you know how it is, and this is a very fast, newly developing field. The idea that reactivation alone launches reconsolidation spread. And to this day, all these science journalism articles still say that, you know, every memory goes into reconsolidation once every time it's reactivated. Not true.
Not
so
true.
So just alerting you and your listeners to this misconception that is
okay.
Still widespread about reconsolidation. what is required. The brain's own intrinsic rules for reconsolidation requires this first step of reactivation and this second step, in which while the target learning is emotionally reactivated, so this first experience of reactivation is still happening, concurrent with it, a second experience of the vivid contradictory knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So that a mismatch, the neuroscientists who have focused on this often call it a mismatch experience, in which the expectations in the target learning and the knowings in the target learning are sharply contradicted by this other equally vivid, equally real feeling, personal knowledge and personal perceptions and experience. So for step two with this hypothetical client I'm describing, I would roll right from the completion of step one that I described a few minutes ago into saying, okay, and then on the other side, what you actually have encountered in your on your own life is in so many situations is all sorts of people who remain friendly and relaxed when they see that you've made a mistake. The store clerk was friendly and relaxed about your mistake. Your coworker was friendly and relaxed about your mistake. Your 12th grade teacher was friendly and relaxed about the mistake you made. Your college advisor was friendly and relaxed about your mistake. And others too. All these people are so different from Dad. Can you feel the surprise and maybe even the relief in your body in seeing that? And again, he nods. So that completes step two, the mismatch, or okay, what we call in coherence therapy, the juxtaposition experience.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that makes sense.
Yeah, this side-by-side experience of the expectation of rejection and his clear experience of non-rejection. He had never put those experiences right next to each other in the same field of awareness before, ever. And that's what it takes. That's the mismatch that does this neurological marvel of unlocking the synapses of the target learning. As soon as I've completed that guiding that juxtaposition experience, and as soon as he is allowing the side-by-side strange experience of these two things that both feel real and yet both cannot possibly be true together, that everyone will be like Dad, and yet so many people are not like Dad in this way. As soon as he's having that mismatch experience, we can assume that the synapses are now unlocking. And now it's time to roll forward into step three, which is new learning that will rewrite and erase and replace the target emotional learning. And in the therapy context, all we need to do is keep repeating the juxtaposition experience from step two for that. Keep guiding this felt recognition of, wait a minute, not everybody is like Dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like maybe yeah, two or three more times. And okay, the way I like to, you could do that in many different ways. You could do it as almost like a clear structured technique of re-guiding it. But I like to do it in a very naturalistic way, really by just empathically expressing interest in the juxtaposition experience itself. For example, I might say to him, now for step three, to start step three, something like, I'm wondering, how is it for you to be in touch with both sides like this? Your expectation that most everyone will react like Dad to any mistake, and your own observation again and again that most people don't react like Dad to a mistake you've made, and they stay friendly and relaxed. How is it for you to be in touch with both? So you see, in a very, yeah, you know, natural manner, I've again guided him to bring attention to both, feel both, hold both at once.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the first repetition for step three.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, in the course of continuing to debrief the experience, I'll find, you know, one or two more opportunities to, again, guide his attention to resample the juxtaposition.
Okay.
At that point, the three-step erasure sequence is complete. That's it. You can see that it takes several minutes to do it once I have the necessary ingredients from step ABC.
And ABC might have taken several sessions or more.
Yes. Yes. It usually takes, I never know how many sessions it will take. What I've learned from learning to work in this focused way, I sort of look forward to the surprise of how few sessions it can take, although, you know, it could take two sessions with some clients who have very complex material or very raw traumatic material. It could take 20 sessions, you know, so I don't really care how many sessions it takes as long as I feel I'm making effective use of every session to mm-hmm. do this retrieval work and to find the contradictory knowledge. If there's progress in every session, then, you know, I feel like I'm doing a good job as a therapist. And then we arrive at this 1-2-3 erasure sequence at the earliest possible moment, given the nature of the material and the client's capacities.
We are running short on time, so let's get the V in there.
The final V. The V is for verification. Mm-hmm. And that verification step really is essentially the same as what the neuroscientists do at the end of a reconsolidation experiment. They want to see if the original learning is still there. And really, the only decisive way to do that is, once again, present cues and triggers that previously were very effective at re-triggering and evoking the target learning. So, for example, in therapy, V could be done through an imaginal guided experience in which the client imagines the situations and circumstances that have always triggered this, in our example here, his anxiety among people that if he says something wrong, he'll be rejected and hated for it. Or I could simply wait till the next session and ask the client, so, you know, how was it in, the 10 a.m. Team meeting you have every morning at work where you always feel this anxiety, you know, as discussion is going on. And if he says, you know, I didn't feel it anymore, you know. I had one client once who told me, he said, you know, I always expected that if I was free of this, I would just be like always ecstatic or always brilliant or always, you know, powerful feeling. And he said, you know, it's not like that. I'm free of it, and it's just like life is ordinary now. I'm just not anxious all the time.
Isn't that how we are as human beings?
Yeah.
It's like when we've got a symptom, it's really in our face, and when it goes away, sometimes we don't even notice it or remember.
Listen, Dave, I've seen that just as you said. I've had clients for whom massive afflicting symptoms fall away, and within a couple of weeks, when I remind them of how a certain situation used to feel, they sort of stare at me with wide eyes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was like that.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've noticed that in myself physically going to the doctor, you know. And,
yes.
You know, sometimes they, you know, he may make reference to, and how's that such and such, that pain that you were complaining about last time? Oh, really?
Yes.
What pain was that? I don't remember.
We take for granted our well-being so easily. It's really something.
Yeah.
And so we deliberately work to have the client encounter the triggers. We actually will try to re-evoke the symptom or the troubling reaction in every way that used to re-evoke it. And we know that the job is done only when it just doesn't re-evoke. And we often hear clients in the process of trying to re-trigger it and revisiting the moments that would re-trigger it say things like, gee, you know, it seems kind of silly to respond that way now. We've had clients actually break out into a delighted laughter, not nervous laughter, real free energy, glee at how great it feels to no longer have that response. And it just seems absurd to respond that way now once the erasure is successful. Now, it's not always immediately successful. We don't have time for that, I realize, because the erasure is allowed by the client's mind and brain only if the emotional consequences of the big shift in personal reality that is involved in the erasure is emotionally workable in every way. If there's any aspect of the shift that's emotionally too daunting, then the erasure is blocked and we have to then do the process of finding and facing in a gentle, gradual manner, what are the consequences of the shift that don't feel workable yet? And really go into that. And at the point where the consequences, the emotional consequences of the shift do feel workable, whether that's one or two sessions later or six or eight sessions later, we then repeat the 1-2-3 sequence, and then the erasure works.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I'm sorry that we are running short on time. I think the one thing that we would definitely want to touch on before we close off is I could imagine that there might be people out there who are listening to what we've been talking about and would want to be clients of a therapist who is trained in this. And there would be therapists and potential therapists listening who would want to get that training for themselves. So what are your recommendations on those two scores? How can people both find therapists who would know, who would be skilled in this, and how can therapists find training?
Okay, yes. We're actually working right now on putting together a referral directory. So in the meantime, people should email us at info@coherencetherapy.org, coherencetherapy.org, info@coherencetherapy.org. And, of course, a lot of other information is available on our website, which is coherencetherapy.org.
Okay.
Good.
And so that would be true for both potential clients and therapists. I imagine you have a workshop schedule on your website.
Right.
Okay, well, that's great. Bruce Ecker, it's so great to speak with you again, and I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
Well, once again, I hope you are stimulated by this conversation with Bruce Ecker as I was. It's a perfect follow-on, I think, to last week's interview with Dr. Jaak Panksepp on the neuroevolutionary origins of human emotions. I praised the Panksepp book as a potential classic, and I hope I won't seem overly effusive, but I have to say that I think that Ecker's book on unlocking the emotional brain is destined to be a landmark publication as well. One of the questions that I didn't have time to cover with Bruce was whether he would agree with my perception that the different schools or brands of therapy may be in the process of going away. I think I've observed here previously that I'm sensing an emerging consensus in the field of psychotherapy. I did put this question to Bruce after the recorder was turned off, and he strongly agrees. I told him that I think Memory Reconsolidation and his book could be the hub around which the various approaches unite. He affirmed that that is his hope and vision. I hope this book gets very wide circulation. I think it's essential reading for therapists of all stripes and, at the same time, will be of considerable interest to many in the general reading public, especially for my audience. For all you therapists and therapists in training, I'd suggest that this book is an excellent starting place, but personally, I'd want to get some direct training and supervision from his group before I'd embark on this course. The book lays it all out very clearly on the one hand, and on the other, I think there are enough subtleties and nuances that getting some training and supervised experience would be highly desirable. His book, Unlocking the Emotional Brain, is remarkably just over 200 pages and is available in an affordable softcover format as well as a Kindle edition. You can order either using our Amazon affiliate tool in the right-hand sidebar on our site. Once again, I deliberately let this interview run longer than usual because I feel Bruce Ecker's work is that important. I'll try to keep the rest of the show quite brief. You'll be hearing this show in mid-December, and as they say, 'tis the season for giving. Shrink Wrap Radio brings you amazing interviews with incredible guests every week. I put in 10 or more hours on each episode. You have free access to at this point, 330 interviews, 7 years of work, and this is supported by listener donations from about 20 to 30 people each month. I'm very grateful for all those donations, but 20 to 30 people, when some of the episodes are downloaded by more than 5,000 of you, if all those people committed to only $5 a month, I'd be getting a living wage out of this. Please make a stocking stuffer donation of $5 a month or more to Shrink Wrap Radio. I hope you have received our second newsletter that I put out with the help of our partner, the Jung Platform. If you didn't receive that newsletter and would like to, you can sign up for our mailing list on our site in the upper left-hand corner, and you'll receive a free link to a dream lecture I gave some years ago. Finally, I want to let you know that we have a new transcript on the site thanks to the generous work of Gemma Sidney. We have a transcript of Shrink Wrap Radio number 329, The Emotional Foundation of Mind with Jacques Panksepp. Thank you, Gemma. Talk about a gift. I think Dr. Panksepp's work is so important, and I'm sure many students out there are going to want to reference it.
Hi, this is David Shane, a Jungian analyst and author. You're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. David Shane, who will be my next guest. More about that in a moment. In the interest of time, I'll read just one email from our listener community, and it's from Chicago blogger and podcaster and creative writer Cesar Torres, who interviewed me some time back for his show. Cesar writes, David, loved your episode with Dr. Bosnak and Jung's Red Book. I just wrote about dream journaling, and I linked to your show on my site. I hope all is well. I loved having you on my show. Stay in touch. And you can go to Cesar's blog at www.cesartorres.net. And Torres is spelled T-O-R-R-E-S. So with that, I think we better wrap it up here. And I'll also skip over the usual contact information. Thanks to today's guest, Bruce Ecker, for sharing his groundbreaking work on unlocking memories in the emotional brain. My next guest will be Jungian analyst Dr. David Shane, speaking about a Jungian model of addiction. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.